Time for Sportslet 101. Bruce Pratt joining us via the magic of technology from beautiful Albany, New York. Hello there, Bruce.
Hello, guys. It's a beautiful day here just outside Albany, and really interesting book to talk about.
Yeah, you mentioned it a couple of times, and you had my curiosity. It was just a question of whether or not it would be as good a read as promised, and it sounds like it delivered.
Yeah, you know, as I was reading, I was thinking about a conversation I had in 1969 by the side of the road in Hungary, outside a Warsaw Pact army base, where my two friends and I had spent the night sleeping in the rough while we were hitchhiking, and a young soldier came up to us, and he spoke English, and he said, "Where are you from?" And I told him I was from Connecticut, and he went, "It's near Brooklyn. You know my cousin, George?" And I thought, the world is small, but it's not that small. That, you know, I didn't know his cousin, George. And I thought that really, in a sense, here were two people from completely different worlds, and he thought we might have something in common. That's sort of what this book is about, in a way, that the great friendship, long-term friendship between Al the Bull Ferrara and Emil Buddy Bavese. Now, for people that don't know who Buddy Bavese was, he was the longtime GM of the Dodgers, and also was a card owner and a GM under Ray Kroc of the Padres. And Al the Bull Ferrara was a kid from Brooklyn who may have been the hardest partier in the history of Major League Baseball, and may have been one of the most, reckless off the field guys, but was a beloved teammate and a great player on the field. And there's a similarity between Buzzy Bavese and Al Ferrara, which is at the heart of this story in many ways. So I want to set this up a little bit before going into detail of what the book is really about, because it focuses on the 1965 Dodgers World Championship Series. But Emil Buddy Bavese was born to a fellow by the name of Frenchy. And Frenchy Bavese was Italian. So why would an Italian guy be named Frenchy? Well, because they had emigrated from Italy to Marseille in France and then on to the United States. And Frenchy had opened a tailor shop in Marseille. And when he came to the U.S., he was working as a print typesetter. And one day it occurred to him that the fact that all the newsstands in New York City got their papers delivered by someone delivered the Times, someone delivered the Tribune, someone delivered the Globe, someone delivered the Herald. He thought, well, wouldn't it be something if somebody delivered for all of them? And he borrowed $500, got a horse and buggy, and a horse and a wagon, and he started a business. And a few years later, he had 80 trucks traveling all over Westchester and Long Island and Connecticut. And he was living in Scarsdale, New York. Yet first generation, made it with money, immigrant success story. Now, the Ferraras on the other side were also Italian. He was the son of Italian immigrants, Al the Bull Ferrara, who didn't do as well. And his mother died when he was very young, and was much more hard scrabble. He was a good athlete, and he did okay in school, but he was not. He and Buddy Bavese were really, in many ways, the opposite of each other. One growing up well-to-do in Scarsdale, and one growing up in a lower middle-class home in Brooklyn. But later, they're going to become friends when Bavese decides that Al Ferrara is a guy worth investing in as a baseball player. And this is in the days before metrics. And this is what makes this such a wonderful story. Because if you went by metrics alone, I don't know whether Al Ferrara ever becomes a major league player. And he never becomes a full-time major league player until the end of his career with the Padres. But he is everybody's favorite teammate, from Sandy Koufax to Lou Johnson to Don Drysdale to Johnny Roseborough. Here's this Italian guy from Brooklyn charms them all, because they say he was, in the dugout, the best guy you could possibly have. Now, he managed to get demoted for bad behavior. He managed to be told by Buddy Bavese that his major league career was over. It wasn't. He managed to get into scrapes on two continents, three actually, if you count Japan. He was known to blow through money, addicted to the ponies, would step outside the dugout to have a cigarette when he was knew he was going to go up to pinch hit was not the guy you think of as a great athlete. But he lived in baseball for about 14 seasons on and off because he was such a presence on the field. I mean, he would get injured because he was the guy that would dive to make the catch that somebody else wouldn't. He would crash into the wall. He wasn't reckless on the field. He tried to be a good player. But he said, and Ferrara, and I love this quote, he said, Mays, Mantle, those guys are naturals. Guys like me have to work really hard just to be on the team. And it's really a remarkable story because if you think about all the wrong turns this guy made in his life, and he's still alive and he's turned his life around and he's doing great things post-baseball, but he probably should never have been there. And I would believe that today people would just look at the numbers and say, yeah, we don't need this guy. I can get a 270 right-handed hitter. Well, but the thing was, he was a clutch player as well. He could play a number of positions, though he was primarily an outfielder. And Bavese never would give up on him. Just he just wouldn't. And it turns out that Bavese was also a guy who would do all kinds of things for ball players that the O'Malleys didn't want him to do. Now, during this entire time that Bavese is with the Dodgers, Walter Alston is the manager, getting his one-year renewable contracts, which he was famous for. Vin Scully's the announcer. Scully's praise for Ferrara as a person was just stunning to read. And during all this time, Bavese had a budget, and O'Malley wouldn't budge. And his creative ways of finding ways to keep players and to build the Dodgers is in itself a great story. Just and it's all told here. And what makes the book great is the writer is a guy named Ken Lezebnik. He was best known as the head writer and producer of Touched by an Angel and a number of other TV shows. So he has a background in how to tell a story in a short space, which can be good for books like this. This is not crammed with a lot of unnecessary detail. You don't have a tremendous amount of statistics. But what you also have is a book that talks about these two people in their coming of age and mastering their trade right in the heart of the Watts riots, the civil rights movement, the changing, if you will, of the guard from the Eisenhower generation to whatever we're going to call the generation after it. And he manages to tell all that story without preaching, without spending a lot of time going on about things that aren't important, and telling the story of two men who, Italian-Americans from New York, who were understood absolutely why all the changes that were going on were important and embraced them. They weren't old school throwbacks who didn't embrace it. And I liked one of the things that Lee Loewenfish, who wrote the great Branch Rickey biography, said, Ruth and Garrick, Spahn and Sane, Abbott and Costello, add Buzzy and the Bull. And it's a story that people don't know because we know that the antics of baseball players were kept out of the news in the 60s. Otherwise, Mantle and those guys probably would have spent their life in jail. So it lets us look at the bad side of baseball. It lets us look at some things that from that era that are pretty unsavory. But it also lets us really see sport evolving with the times. And, you know, I think it's so relevant, especially what you brought up about how the Celtics and the Raptors might make a statement about what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin. There are some times, and Buzzy Bavese knew this well, and Ferrara knew it well, when life is bigger than sports. And though they're both diehard, devoted guys, that comes through in the book, too.
Speaking of that, some breaking news in the Milwaukee Bucks, the first NBA team to boycott one of these playoff games in protest of the shootings in Kenosha. They did not show up for their scheduled Game 5 against the Orlando Magic. It sounds like the Magic may have known about it. The Magic waited on the court until the clock ran down before the game and then walked off into their locker room.
I wonder what they're going to do about that. Are they going to make them forfeit that game, or are they going to show some guts?
Yeah, that's an interesting choice to be made there by Commissioner Adam Silver.
Absolutely. And, you know, and talk about commissioners. It's interesting. how the GMs in the old days in baseball, really, they didn't have these some of the issues with commissioners that we see today. They're not, you know, the kind of Rob Manfred kind of behavior doesn't seem to be present. And the interesting thing about the Bavezis is all three of his sons are either GMs or were GMs or own baseball teams. The youngest one, Bob, who wrote the introduction here, is a lawyer. And we talked about him and we talked about Will Gahagan's book about summer baseball, summer league baseball, because he owns a team in that Northern Midwest League. I forget what it's called. And so that there's sort of a handing down of tradition from the Bavezis. And it would seem to me when I look at the teams that they represented that he must have been a really, really classy guy.
Now, he traded away Al Ferrara, who, by the way, my greatest memory of Al Ferrara is that seemingly every pack of baseball cards I bought as a kid had either an Al Ferrara or a Dick McAuliffe card. But but he had a very good season in 67, in 122 games, 277, 16 homers, 50 runs batted in, did not play much in 68, I assume was injured, and then traded away the San Diego Padres.
Yeah, well, actually, he didn't get traded, actually. What happened was he was basically told he could make a deal.
Ah.
And Bavezzi wanted him on his team. And what's interesting about that one really good year he had is, yes, the next year he missed most of the 68 season with an injury. Now, here's a guy who occasionally had to get stitched up because of off-the-field altercations. And he would wear a batting glove to hide it or keep his glove on in the dugout so they couldn't see it. He had a lot of injuries, Ferrari. Yeah, he and Dick McAuliffe, and there was one other. I don't know how many Joe Adcock cards I got.
Oh, yes, yes.
Late 50s. But yeah, I mean, I we kept the McAuliffe cards because I lived in Connecticut at the time, and he was from Unionville, Connecticut, so everybody wanted a Dick McAuliffe card. I think my bike spokes had many an Al Ferrara card run through.
And Kerry, look at this Al Ferrara baseball card from mid-career. He's in his mid to late 20s. Tell me he doesn't look like a 49-year-old insurance salesman.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
What is exactly he looking at there?
Staring up into the sky at something. I don't know what.
Oh, God.
Well, he played lots of pranks, and he was a real big joker. There's a great story in here, too, about you learn a lot about Koufax and Drysdale and just what a warrior Koufax was. And when Koufax didn't pitch in 65 on Yom Kippur, he wasn't particularly religious, Koufax, but he thought this will bring some attention to some things he wanted to bring attention to, and they could use start Drysdale or Koufax because they both had enough rest. So Drysdale goes out, and the Twins bomb him. When Olson went out to take Drysdale out, Ferrara was able to told the author about the thing Drysdale said was, "Yeah, I bet you wish I was Jewish too." Which may be one of the funniest lines I've ever heard. So the book is peppered with those kinds of memories because Ken Lezebnik spent lots of hours with Ferrara and many, many, many hours interviewing him and talking to him and with lots of the Bavezzi family so that much of the information he got came firsthand. Yes, he did research. He talked to other players. But the fact that he found, I think what's really interesting is the fact that this book was ever written is in itself a testament to how many great stories there are we don't know. Because, I mean, I knew, the Bavezzis were general managers. Beyond that, I didn't know anything about him. Al Ferrara was a guy who played for the Dodgers who I didn't see a lot because I was an American League fan and he was in every baseball pack, every card, a pack of cards. I really think now that there's a real tale to be learned here. As my friend Mark Berlin, that used to own Bookmarks, always said, Americans read for information. And there's a tremendous amount of information in this book that makes us understand that, underneath it all, a lot of us are pretty much the same. And it's easy, and I always tell my students this, it's really, really easy to notice differences between people, but sometimes it's a lot harder to find the commonality. And the fact that these two guys remained friends, remained in contact, wrote letters to each other right up until the day that that Buddy Bavese died, that Buddy Bavese's wartime letters and correspondence with his wife and correspondence between the Farrars. I mean, there's enough in here for 100 great stories. And it's, as I say, it's only about 170 pages of the text with very short notes in the backs. It's not at all a college professor book. It's a book that's intended to really tell you a story. And another one of the stories it tells is the story of the transistor radio, which Bavese swore revolutionized baseball as much as any other invention. Because you could listen.
And boy, and I did too. Listen to those out of town games back in the day. Pick up, was it 3WE out of Cleveland, and listen to Sudden Sam McDowell when I was a kid?
WLS out of Chicago. Mm. Or is that Cincinnati? I forget. I used to listen to, I used to be able to get on the skip in Connecticut sometimes, games from White Sox. Not the Cubs, they didn't play at night in those days, but the White Sox, the Pirates, the Phillies. You'd remember the ads, Joe Niagara, in Philadelphia. How high does a 25-pound meatball bounce? It doesn't. Now we reveal it, Niagara Ford, right? There were always great ads and things that you remembered. But he talked about the transistor radio allowed people to follow their teams when they weren't on television, or for people that didn't have televisions. And we forget that even in the early 60s, there were people without television sets. I mean, I remember we got ours, I think, in our first one in 1956 or 7. I was 5 or 6. And I knew people in 1963 that had just gotten their first TV. And he really talked about how in the 40s and 50s, baseball became a bigger part of American culture because people could start to listen on the radio. And as he said about L.A., if you had Vin Scully, if you're listening to him, you're going to want to listen to more baseball, because whoever was better.
Well, and even if you had television, there were only a handful of games that were actually broadcast on TV.
Oh, yeah. And he talked about night games that people could, guys at work, the second shift would listen on the radio, or, I'm sure you did it too. Oh, yeah, Mom, I'm asleep. Yeah. Headphone in, under the covers, turn on the transistor to catch the game.
No doubt about it. The book is called Buzzy and the Bull. Bruce, thank you. What's on next week's Sports Lit?
I'm not sure. We may. I'm working on the possibility of a guest. And if not, Travis Vogan has edited a new book along with another person, which I just started looking at today, about sports documentaries and how they form impressions for us. And it's a lot about ESPN's 30 for 30, but also a lot about documentaries made about athletes and sports, staying away from commercial films like Chariots of Fire and things like that, but focusing on films that were made with a point of view, documentaries made with a point of view. It's a little heavy in the beginning, but I think that particular article, I know the author is being very much an academic. So I'm not really sure, but it'll be one of those two things.
Sounds good. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, sir.